Okay, this is tape 2A. The last tape was tape 1A, and tape 1B failed on us for some reason. Possibly the transformer has been giving us trouble because it was very hot. Thing we talked about on tape 1B, we talked about Rockford Station being supplied by air.
Mm-hmm. That was my understanding from Little America.
Okay. And then you described a precautionary landing.
Yes, I had to go to Byrd on a visit as part of my duties as in charge of the post offices. And we were forced down on the way back because, when I say forced down, we had to make a on-schedule landing in the middle of Murray Birdland because Little America was socked in, and I guess we didn't have enough fuel to go back to Byrd and then go back to Little America the next day. So we landed on the ice and set up tents and heated the engines and with one of the, not James Wade, but there's a name for those,
Herman Nelson preheater?
Yes, the Herman Nelson. And waited out. Next morning we were able to take off and go back to Little America.
Okay, let's talk about the Bert Crary incidents. What was Bert doing out on the edge of the ice, for starters?
He was making a hydrographic station just off Little America. He had made one at the North Pole when he was on T3 before he went to Antarctica, and now he was going to make one as close to the South Pole as he possibly could get, which was the indentation of Keenan Bay, where Little America was built.
Was there anybody out there with him?
Yes, a gentleman by the name of Hartung or Hartug.
Stephen Den Hartug?
Yes, it sounds right.
Uh-huh. And what was your involvement?
I happened to be OD that day. I was actually OD almost any day.
What's OD?
Officer of the day. Okay. And that was one of my duties as assistant officer in charge of Little America, was to more or less always be the man to call if something was gone wrong and you were to look into what had to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the first I knew about it is Hartog, when was standing back off the edge, and Bert was at the edge, dropping lines over, was about 100 to 150 feet off the water to get samples of the ocean for salinity tests and also temperature and that sort of thing. And what he was standing on calved off, and he went tumbling into the ocean with the piece of ice that he was standing on. Mm-hmm. The edge just shaved off. And Hartog, as I understand it, was a few feet behind him and obviously didn't go over. And he went over, and he was at the edge at that point because the edge came up to his feet, or close to it, and he looked over and he saw Bert thrashing around in the water, and he climbed onto an ice floe, and at which point Hartog ran back to the snow cap, which obviously did not have a radio because he didn't call anybody, and raced back to the base, ran into my office, which was part of COM, and shouted that, you know, Bert's over the in the water, he fell over the edge.
Was this summer?
I think it was just before summer.
Okay.
Because Bert hadn't gone out on his traverse yet, his great crossing. And that, I think, occurred just before summer started the second time. Anyway, I passed the word, although I don't remember it, I had to have passed the word to Captain Mayer and to Thompson. And then I went down with Hartog in the... and the snowcat to look over the edge at Bert. And a few minutes later, half the base came down because the word was passed. You know how the word gets around when there's only 109 men. And everybody was down there, 40 or 50 of them. And a few minutes later, the helicopter got up. Some people ran back. Everybody turned to run back to do things. The medical people to get something called a Stokes stretcher, by the way, that they could carry him if they could get him ashore, and also other equipment and blankets, and somebody ran out the keel field to whip him up and get him to understand they had to get in the air quick. And they did come down. My memory was that Captain Mayer was... I have two memories of that. One was that he got somehow went over the edge, got into a small skiff, a sort of like a rowboat, went out to the ice floe and tried to get him into the boat. They couldn't do it. And then when the helicopter came over, they brought the rope down. Crary at that point was too weak to hang on, and Captain Mayer got onto the ice floe and put his arms around him in a bear hug, and they raised them both up. That was a memory I've had for years, but recently thinking about it, I think it happened that the helicopter landed. Captain Mayer got into the helicopter, and they went over, and they dropped the line, and he went down with the line as they lowered him. You know, they strapped him into the line. When he got down there, he just wrapped his arms around Bert, and they brought them both back up to the helicopter. There is an article that was published in Collier Magazine, which is no longer in print, within a month or two of the incident, that detailed it with very good pictures. It was a 2 or 3 page article. And I've always been meaning, when I go by these magazine archive places, to look it up and see. And that would, of course, have all the exact details. I don't know why I have this false picture. I did, you know. Memory's a funny thing sometimes. But we all went back, and I saw Bert that evening. I visited him in his cabin, and in his quarters, and seven, and he was awake by then. The doctor said his temperature had clocked in at 76 or something when they brought him off the ice, which is incredibly bad. He had gone into the water, climbed out, and started to bounce around, and as he explained it from his bedside or from his bed, he noticed that this piece of ice, which was only a yard or two long and a yard wide, was beginning to disintegrate from this pounding. He was a fairly heavy man, so he thought, oh, shit, I can't do that. And so he stopped, and then, of course, by then his clothes had frozen, so he was sort of in an eggshell of ice, which kept him, to a certain extent, insulated from the wind and whatnot. When the helicopter finally got him ashore, he was still in pretty bad shape. By the time I saw him that evening, he had recovered. His temperature was back up into the low 90s or 90. And he explained what he saw. He said first he saw Hartung looking over at him, and then Hartung disappeared, or Hartung. And then he said, next thing I know, all these people come to the edge. They look over, they turn around and leave. I thought, oh, shit, now what? I'm lost. But he turned out to be all right.
So he survived and stayed on to work some more.
Yeah, he was an incredibly healthy man.
You went in to see him in the hospital, in the dispensary, correct?
No, he was in his cabin.
Oh, he was in his own cabin?
Oh, yeah, they just put him to bed in his own bed. It was not like nowadays where you'd be hooked up to a machine that would give your heartbeat and everything else. He was just laying in bed there, and they, of course, I guess maybe had a couple of extra blankets on him, and they had given him some things, but no, he was not in sick bay, at least not to my memory.
Okay, well, start of winter. Let's talk about the winter. You mentioned earlier that you had a sinking feeling when everybody left.
Yeah, you really begin to wonder what you've let yourself in for, but it only lasted a day or two. It was caused by the odor of spilled kerosene. It was caused by the 12-foot stair and the people you were leaving, and the obvious friction between you and the group that you were replacing. The food was wonderful. It was plentiful, but it had a certain aftertaste that bothered you. You wondered whether you really made a mistake. But there's so much going on. There was so much to do, so much to see. The sunsets, which came on another month or two later, the certain feeling that you were doing something very, very special on the frontiers of humanity, all that overwhelmed any feeling of regret.
How about the sunset?
Well, one of the beautiful things about Antarctica, and one of the running jokes, is that the sunsets are beautiful. And they last for months. or well, for a couple of months. If you see a beautiful sunset and you come in and somebody says, I just saw a beautiful sunset, you say, well, if I get a chance next week, I'll go out and look at it. Because you can go out there, and I've got some magnificent pictures. The question is, you wait it until the sun just went around the edge of the horizon until it had the right sort of clouds around it to bring out its red color. And of course, once winter had set and the sun was below the horizon, you had the Austria Borealis, the Southern Lights, and you had to look north. That's when you began to realize the uniqueness of where you were. You were far south. You had to look north to see the Southern Lights, and of course the stars were just magnificent because there were no street lamps to bother you.
Yeah. So it was magnificent seeing the Aurora Australis. Okay, tell me about ham radio. Was it very important to...
Extremely important, especially for those people with wives and children north and back in the States. I was a bachelor, but it was still important because I had girlfriends I would call. And of course, my parents. But that ability to telephone or to communicate immediately with your family was extremely important. I had a radioman whose his sister had died, and then his father had a heart attack over the tragedy. And if he had not been able to call home and talk with his mother and his brothers, and had simply gotten that information in two short telegrams, it would have destroyed him. And as it was, he spent a very bad night. I remember setting up all night with him. Talking about it, but the importance of the ham radio cannot be overemphasized, and especially the people that anchored it in the States. There was one gentleman, I can't think of his name right now, I do have an article about him at home, who gave an incredible amount of time, plus amount of his own money, making long distance phone calls from his home. I believe he was in New York someplace, to all over the States, so that people could call and speak to their relatives and their loved ones. Great sacrifice on the part of the ham radio operators that may never have been recognized properly.
So they turned out from all over the world, you say, to relay calls
right,
to your
but
home.
Especially in the States, of course. Mm-hmm. But you could pick up almost anywhere.
What if you lost your ham radio? What would that have done to morale?
It would have been very bad. I of course, we never did lose a ham radio, and I suppose we could have rigged something up. There was other bases that had ham radios, and we could have maybe had a patch through, something like that. But it would have been a problem. But the ham radio was one of the most important things that went on.
Was there hamgrams going out?
Yes, hamgrams. I often said hamgrams rather than make calls. In fact, I have the dubious honor of having traded the New York Stock Exchange from further south than anybody that ever traded it. I had found a station somewhere in New York that once every afternoon gave about 50 or 60 stock quotes and what it did that day. And I meticulously copied them down each day, and after a month or two, I was able to discern a certain direction. And I sent a ham radiogram requesting that they sell out some stock that I own. I dealt with Merrill Lynch at the time, and to purchase another stock, and then got rid of that other stock a couple of weeks later and made a point or two on it. And it got picked up by the New York Times. They had a column of odd news about the market, I think every Thursday or something. And sometime in August, somebody sent me a clipping from the New York Times mentioning that Francis Stokes at the South Pole was trading the stock market.
Did anybody censor the hamgrams going out?
Censor them?
No.
No, there were certain things you couldn't do. There's a certain language you couldn't use.
Couldn't use foul language.
Couldn't use foul language. You weren't supposed to do business, but private business, you know, your financial arrangements were all right.
But not Navy business.
Not Navy business, no. And, of course, you had to not talk about anything that might be secret. Of course, you know, we weren't really doing anything secret, but we didn't talk about operations. You didn't talk about, oh, so-and-so was killed last week in a crevasse or something, you know, because for fear who might see it. And there was a certain amount of censorship in that somebody made a remark in a, and I have some information about that, about drinking at the base on a ham gram, not a ham gram, but a ham patch to home. And it was picked up by the ham radio at the pole station and was the subject of a radio, official radio message from the head of the pole station to Captain Mayer requesting that people not say derogatory things like that on the ham radio.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier you felt ham radio was a cornerstone of morale.
Absolutely. And there wasn't any trouble in censorship. All you had to do was remind the people that the entire world was listening if they wanted to, and never say anything you didn't want everybody in the world to hear.
But no one listened in.
Nobody listened in. And nobody, as far as I know.
Except the radio operator.
Yeah. And nobody abused it, as far as I know.
Okay. Talk about the steam baths. You were talking about steam baths earlier.
The steam baths was probably, if I had to have the second cornerstone of morale at Little America, was the steam bath. The Captain Slagle felt that that would be very beneficial if we were to build a Swedish steam bath and that people would avail themselves of the ability to go out and roll around in the snow after a certain period of time in the bath. And we so did. They went over to a Marble Point and collected a group of boulders and had them flown back. And we had a stove, and there was a certain amount of Kimshaw involved in it. But they had it done, and it was a great, great thing. I mean, it really, I joined the group. There used to be a group that got together every afternoon, just about myself, Captain Slagle, Captain a mayor, Perlich, and the head of VX-6, and one of their head pilots, and a couple of others, and Bert Crary, and we'd, when he was at the base, and we would lounge around and then go outside and run around in the snow a little bit. I wasn't much for rolling around in the snow. I didn't mind running around in it, in the cold air, but dumping into the soft snow wasn't my cup of tea.
So, how many people wintered over?
109 at Little America.
And then you had training down there, Little America College.
Yes. One of the things we did, although I'm not sure this was a cornerstone of morale, is it was felt by the commander of Little America, Tommy Thompson, that we should have some sort of a program of lectures. And we got people that were fairly good in certain subjects to teach those subjects, especially to people that might have needed them for high school graduation or for coming up for exams. And I taught a course in trigonometry. Well, we had this college, as I said a minute ago, was probably not the main cornerstone of morale or the size of the ham radio or the steam bath, but it was important, and we had a number of subjects that we taught. I taught trigonometry. Bert Crary gave lectures as to what he was doing down there. The glaciologist gave them an idea of just what they were doing in their pits. It was quite interesting, although it kind of petered out after a while. We gave diplomas for those that successfully completed the courses, and I've forgotten now what all the courses were. As I said, I taught trigonometry, so that's the one I remember best. But I only had about two students.
Mm-hmm.
But it was important, I guess, to the people that needed to have that subject.
Okay. You talked about IGGIs. What's an IGGI?
An IGGI is the International Geophysical Year Scientist that was down there, and that's a slang word that the enlisted men developed as a sort of a slang name for them, and the Iggies even call themselves Iggies. There's a habit amongst some people to be able to invent words. We had one gentleman in particular that was down there that was very, very skillful at it. He invented any number of words. In fact, at one point I began to make a list thinking it would make a nice article. But he'd use the last word of cigar, called a gar, meaning somebody that was always strutting around. And a fish was somebody that was sort of a sucker that you could always trick into something. And he had pick, which was the last syllable of picnic, meaning a party. You're going to have a pick tonight. We're going to get a six-pack of beer and have a party. It was his particular talent, and these got caught on by everybody in the base. He had that ability, too. He was a very interesting gentleman. He had a little bit of every race in the world in him. He was part black, part Eskimo, part Oriental, and part Caucasian. And so I guess he was every man to everybody. Mm-hmm. And he did very well with that, but he could invent words. Every day he'd have a new word.
Hmm. Okay. Well, here we are, end of the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember the first sunrise?
The sunrises, I don't remember the first one, because the sunrises are very much like sunsets. They look the same. Mm-hmm. Only the thing is, they get a little brighter every day instead of a little darker. I do remember that as the sun rised, it became imperative that Bert get out on the trail. He was going to make one of his great traverses. In fact, I believe the very first one. And we had already sent the bird party, the bird resupply train, the previous summer, near the end of it. And that had been spearheaded by Captain Dawson and T.K. Jones. T.K. was a lieutenant CEC officer that wintered over with us. I'm pretty sure it was near the end of the last summer. I don't think they did it at this point. Over the years, it becomes a little bit foggy. But I think we sent one traverse the previous summer, because I had to. Bird needed the supplies for the winter. And the bird, of course, prepared all winter for this. For the traverse. And as I recall, everything was set out. This is one of those odd things. Everything was laid out behind the base in a long row. And we're going to have a little bit of a ceremony and say goodbye, Bert. And that next day, which was not night, but for us night, a blizzard came in and everything was buried. I've got great before and after pictures. I took a picture of all the tractors lined up, and then the next day all buried in snow with just a couple of things sticking up over the snow. But it got all.
And so he left just as soon as he could after the sun came up.
Yeah.
And that was the Ross Ice Shelf Traverse?
I'm not sure. I don't know what it was called. But it must have been, because he was there. That must have been that one, yeah. He went up as far as the glaciers, as I recall. At the time, of course, we had radio contact with him, and we kept a chart in radio in comm, give an idea where he was.
Yeah, so it went most of the summer.
Yeah.
Okay, and what was different about the second summer than the first?
Well, we were going to get out, and we were the people that, well, first of all, we were making plans to stand down. We were closing Little America.
Mm-hmm. And, why?
Well, it had served its purpose. International Geophysical Year was drawing to a close. It was a year and a half year. And also, Little America had no future. We knew that there was a giant crevasse opening up behind us over towards Keel Field. And incidentally, there was a picture published in the papers a few years afterwards, probably near the end of the 60s, that showed a great flat tabular iceberg, and on the side of it you could see buildings. And it was at the time thought to have been Little America 3. Well, it couldn't have been Little America 3, because that was 37 miles behind us. There'd have been more ice down there than you could think of if it was. And I don't think it was us. But what it probably was, I have a great picture that I took of Little America from the cockpit of the K-Sara-Sara when Gardner and I was flying around. And you can see the crevasse. It's just like you took a pencil and drew it. And as I recall, it goes through Kiel Field. And that was probably one of the Kiel Field hangars or work buildings mm-hmm. that was there.
Yeah.
And that makes more sense to me.
But you were at Cannon Bay.
Cannon Bay.
How far away were you from Little America 3 and 4?
37 miles from Little America 3.
West,
as I understand.
You were east of them.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Now, I never did get out to Little America 3. It was one of my great disappointments, but I never did.
Did you know who picked and why it was picked?
Cannon Bay? Well, Cannon Bay, I think, was probably picked for two or three reasons, one being political, because we'd always been there, and if we were going to have a geographical claim, it didn't hurt to be back at the same place again. Probably second, political in the sense that it was easier to get Congress to give the money because we're going back. Little America. And third, Cannon Bay was right there by Roosevelt Island behind us, which one of the great mysteries. And then there were mountains to the west of it, to the east of us, which were probably very important, and felt that if there was any minerals, it had to be in those mountains. Mm-hmm. And it was easy to get to. It was a natural harbor. Probably the other reasons, I'm not privy to why they chose it, but I suspect that's why it was. Now, why they chose that particular slot, I don't think they would have had they known there was a crevasse opening up behind it.
Mm-hmm. How about, why didn't they go to the Bay of Whales?
I suspect it's because Bay of Whales, I think I read somewhere, is Bay of Whales had disappeared, mm-hmm. and it was just a straight, heavy deal, and this was sort of a bay.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. What?
Huh? Cannon Bay. That's how I've always pronounced it.
Cannon Bay, vice Cannon Bay. Named for the Kainan Maru.
Is that what it was?
I'll be Japanese, done. Yes. Here you are, you're into the summer.
Mm-hmm.
You got Crary off.
Mm-hmm.
Summer's starting. You obviously didn't have a winter overgroup show up for the next winter.
No, we did have summer people come in though.
At summer, were you jealous of them, or you?
Well, there was a couple I was jealous of. My room, of course, they shut down. They shut down Weather Central or moved it to McMurdo in part of it shifting about. And so I had an empty space in my little cubicle, and it was filled by a couple of staff people that were doing the winter tour, the summer tour of Antarctica. And they weren't doing a damn thing. They were just coming down to look it over and take pictures. I had a photographer that came in and lived with me for a week or two. Schulzes or something. He's published a beautiful book, although, how many more books do we need with pictures of penguin eggs and skua gulls? But it was sort of meaningless, but it was beautiful work. We had a Sarkany, a fella came in, he was on the staff. Another one, I can't think of his name. He was from Philadelphia. He came in. He later became a good friend in New Zealand. We used to go out together. But, you figure that these guys have lived in New Zealand all winter, or all our winter, and lived the life of royalty there. And now they're coming down to take the pictures and go back.
Well, they were on Dufek staff.
Yeah, they were Dufek staff. Admiral Dufek came in and visited sometimes in there. Just flew in real quick.
Well, Dufek paid his dues. You know, he was with Byrd in 39,
mm-hmm.
and then he was again for high jump.
Yeah.
And he got dunked on high wire.
I saw that.
He also had a helicopter crash, and he went in the water.
Right.
So he's
paid his dues.
He's been in the field and paid
right.
his dues.
Oh, he paid his dues. No, I don't mind Dufek. it's these young Lieutenant JGs that...
You and I agree there. I can't stand staffies.
and they're on a fast track to Commander, and you know it. And
okay, the Staffies came down. Any other unique things that last summer?
Yeah, there was. I think it's very important.
This is the tail end of IGY.
Right, end of IGY. They were packing gear up. They were pulling gear out, sending it to other bases. We sent a tractor-trailer team across the McMurdo, across the Ross Ice Shelf to McMurdo. Dawson was back to do that. Crary returned from his great traverse. There was a lot going on. A couple of funny stories about the traverse. They lost the tractor into a crevasse just before they got to McMurdo. And but they saved the gentleman. He didn't get killed.
Who drove the tractors across?
There were tractor drivers. This particular fellow that fell in was a Marine, so they probably used Marine tank men or something that could use heavy equipment. But a lot of the heavy equipment operators from the Seabees could drive the tractor trailers.
So they went all the way across to Ross Island.
Yeah, they were all the way over Little America.
Yeah, that's new to me. I didn't know they made that traverse.
Yeah.
And did they take supplies with them? Anything particular, equipment from the base?
As I recall, they took any of our excess gear that we didn't need, supplies, and I think they took a few of our radio stuff. They just demantled them and put them on. I don't know whether they were warehoused or whether they were actually used someplace. They sometimes pull stuff out. They stripped this down pretty well. And I, as I explained earlier in a tape, got the honor of being in charge of the closing detail. There were 10 men, Harry Francis, myself, a couple of Iggy's, and then a group of enlisted men. And our job, after they came and took everybody off and they took them over to Little America on the Arneb, not the Atka, but the Arneb, why we were to be evacuated at some point. Now, officially, I understand it says that the Little America was closed on the 1st of January. And I have a telegram that I sent to my mother telling us that we were going to close Little America on the 18th of January and to no longer send letters there and to send them to a ship. And in actual fact, in my diary, I record on the 18th that the ships are 2 hours off from Little America and will not be in until the 19th. And then a little bit later in the diary, I say that I was the last person to leave. I took a tour of the base, made sure that everything was secure and that things were laid out for anybody. We left the base so that anybody that had found themselves there in distress, like a ship or a plane, could crawl into it and find the things they needed, fire, food, and some radio equipment if they could get it started. Made sure everything was the way it was. And I recorded that it was already getting cold because we had closed down the heating and whatnot, and that Little America was dying, and that was it.
What date was that?
The 19th of January, 1959. And I was the last one. I closed the door, and as the old saying goes, close the door, shut off the light, but don't lock it, because that was under orders, so that anybody could get in.
Okay, who lowered the flag?
The flag had been lowered when they all left.
On the 1st of January.
Yeah.
You didn't put it up again.
No.
Okay, so, but
well, that's my memory that it had been, we certainly didn't put it up.
In reality, you kept it open for a while.
Yeah,
for 19 more days.
Yeah, 19 more days.
Who was the last person to get on the ship?
I was. I went down there, and I'm trying to remember what I did to get down.
So you were the last O&C of Little America.
Yeah, I like the joke that I was a senior officer president ashore and afloat for 10 days, and I would challenge my command for square mile area with anyone then alive, but in actual fact, I've been trying to remember how did I get from the base to the edge of the water where I got on the ship, and what did I do with the snow cat? Just leave it there? I cannot remember. Now, somebody from the ship may have drove me back, you
know. That's a great story. You're the last to leave Little America.
Yeah. And in my diary, I make the statement.
The last man at Little America.
Yeah.
Of all the Little Americas that started in 1928, you were the last.
And when I was...
You're the last Little America. Last American. How's
that? And as I was walking down the way, because it was... walking down the tunnels, and of course it was cooling down now because there wasn't anything in there, and it's tunneled into the side of the ice shelf. It's a little chillier than outside, and there's a certain breeze as air, you know, goes back and forth between the two to equalize it, and there was a little breath. And I wrote my diary, it felt like it was taking its last breaths.
Diary was taking the last breath, huh?
Yeah, the Little America was taking its last breaths. But, you know, and then, of course, a few years later, way it floated out to sea and sank, and it's gone. It's a debris. They call it? When they're looking for a ship that sank, and they...
Derelict?
No, not a derelict, but a...
Abandoned ship?
No, no. This fellow that found the Andrew Dory and all those, they look for a debris spread.
Yeah.
That leads them to it, and there's a debris spread somewhere in the Antarctic Ocean,
yeah,
of all the stuff, you know, my locker and the beds and all, yeah, the stuff that would sink.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Dropped
somewhere
out of the bottom of a...
And it's probably some there in the Ross Sea. That's where it would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting, and that you were the last Little American. So, okay, where'd you go from there?
I went to McMurdo, mm-hmm, and very shortly, the Arneb was the Arneb. They took me by Little America, and not Little America, they took me by McMurdo, and then we headed for New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And typically there was an author aboard that had made friends with Dufek, and he was sent down to write a story about from pole to pole. He had gone to the North Pole and traveled through North and South America, and now he had made it to the South Pole. I've since bought his book. It's sort of interesting. He was writing up Dufek as quite a hero of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I was to have joined the glacier, and I missed it because they kept me back at Little America. And so they said they just simply changed orders that I would return to America on the Arneb. And I decided that I did not want to ride a ship back for 30 days or 40 days. I was ready to go back to civilization after, mm-hmm, a year and a half. So I sent a message out, and part of it was the XO of the Arneb was regular Navy, had no use for Antarcticans, and ordered everybody that was aboard the Arneb, which we had now joined up with our crew, all the radiomen and all that had been sent over 2 weeks before, to shave off their beards and to get in the uniform. And Dufek had sent out a message saying that people that went it over could wear their beards back to the States and for 10 days after that so that their families could see it. Well, I showed him the message, and that made no difference to him at all. He was one of these commander Mustangs that was determined. And I says, well, it does to me. And I sent a message to Admiral Dufek and had him confirm what he had done. And oh, that pissed him off against me. And he ordered that they be allowed to wear their beards back. And because it's a morale thing, a guy spends 2 years down there, that's the least. It doesn't. The Navy always had beards. It's not as if it's a sin. And I decided that wasn't a wise thing for me to do. So when we got to New Zealand, I went and requested that I be given orders back. And it took a couple of days, but I got orders to fly home.
Why home?
I flew home on a Navy Navy plane. I don't know what kind. It was an R-4D, I guess. It was great fun. I got to spend an extra 6 or 7 days in Christchurch, and mm-hmm, the whole town came out to see us off with the Lord Mayor, and we took off and lost an engine, and they had to stream the the gasoline and come back and land again. So everybody went out partying for two more days. The Lord Mayor was there. We took off and we lost the engine again. And they streamed gas and came back and landed again. And the Lord Mayor was overheard that if they go again, would they land in Auckland three times in the same place as in cricket?
Oh, it was cricket?
Well, no, he said Auckland. It wasn't cricket to hit Christchurch three times in a row.
Oh, okay.
To land
yeah.
in Auckland the next time. Because, you know, those guys were really wild. You can imagine after a year and a half, they were getting gals pregnant left and right. And, you know, well, you were there.
A lot of them got married.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, okay, you came back. You detached from Deep Freeze?
I came back.
All
I have to think for a minute.
Or?
I went to Davisonville, and I tendered my resignation. I had given it a lot of thought. I'd had some leave, and I had taken the leave. And I gave it a lot of thought, and I decided what I wanted to do was go into the stock market. I felt that, and I had learned since then, that going to Antarctica was very bad. I'd gone by, but the first thing I did is I went by the Bureau, and I asked where my next duty would be. And this was all pre-Zumwalt days, and they were all business. Well, you've had shore duty, and you've had shore duty out of rotation. I says, where the hell do you get I got shore duty? You spent 2 years ashore in Antarctica. This was the lieutenant that I'm talking to. I'm a Lieutenant J.G. And I said, well, that's ridiculous.
You're telling you were on a floating...
Yeah, I was on an ice shelf. And I said, I haven't seen a woman until I landed at Andrews Air Force Base. I forgot to tell him about New Zealand. And I said, hell, if you say... He wanted to send me up to the dew line because I'd already had certain training in ice. And I said, oh, you send me up to the dew line, you know, a month going around the dew line and a week in Greenland someplace, I'm going to come back married to the bosun mate. I said, that's silly. And I said, I'll just tender my resignation. And I did.
Okay, you got out, and did you stay in the reserve?
I was by necessity, I had to be in reserves, but I wasn't active. I went into the stock market in Washington, D.C., began to get involved in young Republican politics, and traded the market, and I was very lucky the first year. I hit it big in soybeans, and then began to give it all back over the next 3 or 4 years, and as I learned the trade. And I, at some point, began to miss the service. I had a girlfriend in Norfolk, and I used to go down to Norfolk quite a bit. And I was using the bases, and I realized I couldn't use the bases anymore unless I got active in the reserves. They sent me messages that you're about to be, you know, taken out. So I called up, and they said, well, you know, we need somebody with your qualifications in a unit we have called, I thought he said N-Sword. I said, oh, that must be some kind of a new weapon system, the Navy Sword. Okay, I'll do that. I know a lot about weapons. And the guy goes, well, weapons? What are you talking about? I said, the N-Swords, or it was N-Sorg, Naval Control of Shipping. And I stayed in that till I got out of the service.
Mm-hmm.
7, 8 years ago, whenever it was, 10 years.
2 weeks every summer?
Mm-hmm. 2 weeks every summer. Near the end, I did a lot more. Mm-hmm. I was going to senior officer courses and things like that. In the 9th Naval District, there for about 2 years, I was the guy they hoped would make admiral for him. Every district has somebody they hope will make admiral. Mm-hmm. And so they send that person to a lot of schools. So I was doing a month active duty the last 2 or 3 years. I didn't make admiral, obviously.
He went back to Antarctica, where you and I met.
Yes.
When was that, the first time you went
No,
back?
That was the second time. The first time I went was aboard the... Hillary and Fuchs were going back for reunion in 1994. And somebody that knew that I was there invited me to come along on the ship. And
this is as a naval officer? Or?
No, he wasn't, but he was
a... as a naval officer.
Excuse me?
You as a naval officer?
No, me as somebody that had been down there when Fuchs was there. So I looked into it, and they gave me a break, for the cost. I paid my way.
Which ship was this?
I'm trying to think of it. It's the only ship in that particular
Russian?
No, it's an American. It was owned by a Chinese out of Hong Kong, and now Norwegian Lines have purchased it. And it's the it's a big, beautiful ship.
Explorer?
No, it's not the Explorer. It has 500. It was the first large ship, and it made a tour first of the peninsula, crossed the Ross Shelf, across sea, and went to McMurdo, where Hillary and Fuchs did a. You could see just really burn Fuchs a little bit, but he's a gentleman. I really enjoy Fuchs.
So Fuchs and Hillary were both there together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was Fuchs died a few years after, 2 or 3 years after.
Okay.
Oh, I'll think of that name of that ship. It's still operating. In fact, they just sent me a...
So did you lecture on this?
Yes, I lectured on it.
Did they lecture?
Hmm?
Fuchs and Hillary lecture?
Yes, in fact, Hillary lectured just before I lectured, and my opening statement was, is not everybody uses Hillary as a warm-up, mm-hmm. which got a good, put the crowd in the right mood.
Was he a good speaker?
No, and he kind of rambled on about what he's done in Tibet after he climbed the mountain. And Fuchs didn't have too much to say. I did hold an impromptu meeting of the Explorers Club. There was Fuchs, Hillary, myself, Paul Sapira, and two other people who just happened to be on board that were members. There were six of us. We took a picture, wrote it up, and we put it in the Explorers magazine.
How many passengers?
550, as I remember.
Wow.
It was a big ship. I was really
against it. Did they all go ashore in the...
Every one of them went ashore at McMurdo.
At McMurdo, but in the landing sites in the peninsula.
Yeah, they all did. They took once?
Well,
they didn't have 500 ashore. They staggered it, I think. Some had to come back aboard when they went ashore. Not the Odyssey.
Marco Polo,
that was it. The Marco Polo. And I liked the ship. The captain looked just like Bush. I think he damn near killed a dozen people. And we almost sank in the Drake Passage, and he refused to admit it.
How did he almost sink?
We lost engine power right just south of the point. And... it started to roll badly when it tore the way. We went atore the waves and began to roll badly. Anything that wasn't tied down began to crash down. It was a beautifully decorated ship with a lot of statues. And they passed the word nobody was to leave their cabins to stay. It happened about 6-7 o'clock in the morning, to stay in their rooms and wait. Well, I know enough about ships when they're like that. I'm not about to stay in my room, in my cabin. I want to be topside. I might freeze to death, but at least I'll be on the top of the water, not underneath it. And
did you lose any of the boats?
No, we didn't lose any of the boats. They finally got her started, and what the story was, there were two stories. One story was, well, there was just a little water in the oil, and that put the engines out. And then the other story that went around by the crew was that several of the bunkers were filled with salt water, not with fuel oil. And they had, this was their maiden voyage. They'd had one short voyage of a week or two.
You mean, maiden voyage to Antarctica?
Voyage. They were built. They had their what do they call it when they fix it out in Greece? They sailed from Greece across the Atlantic, which I guess technically was their maiden voyage, mm-hmm. and took on some Antarctic people and went to a lot of the South Georgia. And to where they had Elba Island and those places, and then came over and picked us up. So we were still within 2 or 3 weeks of its maiden start. And
second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I felt that this was so dangerous. If there were bunkers that were filled with salt water instead of oil. We were in great danger. And there was no mention of it. It was like nothing happened. But it was an incredible amount of damage done to the artwork and to the dishes and the gallery, and the galley, rather. And, you know, it really could have been an absolute disaster. Another thing bothered me about that ship.
This was in the Drake, right?
It was Drake. It was just south of
Cape Horn.
Cape Horn. Almost dead south of it. And we were really being pushed around by the waves. And we could have rolled very easily. Or, well, could have got water down the stacks, and then it didn't matter what was in our bunker, you know. But they poo-pooed it. Wasn't much of a deal. Of course, they had to, because, you know, they were going to continue to operate the ship. When we got the McMurdo, they put everybody ashore, everybody. And then a storm, you know how those storms blow in suddenly, and they let everybody hang around and hang around. And when they finally went back to the ship, why, they took, myself, in my particular raft, they took almost an hour to get us off the water onto the ship. And how they didn't lose some of the old women against that ship, I just about had an egg crushed. And
why didn't they leave them ashore in McMurdo? I mean, you got a nice base there, and they could take care of them.
Yeah, and come back the next morning if they felt it was going to blow over. I felt that that was an awful, dangerous operation. And I really, I felt that I damn near lost a leg or could have been drowned, you know, as they tried to struggle to get us back aboard. And they struggled for hours. When I did get aboard, I was soaking wet and cold as can be.
And how about Hillary and Fuchs?
They were already aboard. They had already had their ceremony and all. And they'd gone over to Scott Base.
Yeah,
you know, they didn't invite us over for that. They didn't invite anybody over for that. They did that all within themselves, that I'm aware of.
It's a shame they didn't invite you.
Yeah, well, you know, one of those things. But I enjoyed it very much. But I was shocked at how dangerous landing with these, what do they call them now, these rubber boats?
Zodiacs?
Zodiacs was. Not so much landing as returning to the ship in that particular incident. And I just think that they came so close to losing somebody that that people don't realize, you know, and I'm sure that's why they don't publicize it. Then I went down on the Russian icebreaker where I met you, and I enjoyed that. I felt
that was later. That's when we were on the Dranitsin?
Yeah. That was about a year later. That was 1 year later, exactly.
That was December 94.
Yeah, and this was the summer of the winter of 94. See, we were in the McMurdo very late. It was the end of January. And it was beginning to, it was too late in the season to bring a ship that size into McMurdo.
So you returned to the peninsula
11 months later.
Sure.
Now, the way that came about is I was connected with Paul Sapira. He's the gentleman that suggested that I ought to try to go down with on the Marco Polo. And he had been in the Antarctic about the time he knows you. I mentioned to him.
Sapira.
It's a Polish name. Mm-hmm. And you were commander of the base when he was there. And he was looking for meteorites, and he was a summer scientist. And within about 2 weeks, there was a fire, and it burned his face badly, and he was medevaced out. And but he's a real aggressive guy. That's you know, he's been back twice. He's led two expeditions that we have supported and developed.
So Frankie. He was with one of Bill Casting company when I worked for meteorites.
And Paul was. We were planning to try and get the Planetary Studies Foundation into the business of bringing people to Antarctica, primarily to look for meteorites, and because that's his specialty. He's a planetary studies scientist. And
tell me about the Planetary Studies Foundation. What is it?
It's a group out of Harper College that's purpose is to eventually build a planetarium for Harper College, but in actual fact, its primary thrust is in the study of meteorites and what it tells us about the planets. And Paul Sapir is a professor of planetary studies at the Harper College, and he, somewhere in his career, met the DuPont, the New Jersey DuPonts, and he had one of the world's largest collection of meteorites, and he had Paul study them for him. And when he died, Mrs. DuPont, that learned to know Paul and to like him, asked Paul to evaluate them for the estate and ended up giving them to the Planetary Studies Foundation. I've been a guest at their home in northern New Jersey, and they're worth $500,000, and we've since expanded. And we now have the world's 9th or 10th largest collection of meteorites. And we're continuing.
The
Planetary Studies Foundation.
So you joined, it's open to the public to join?
Yes, if you'd like to join. It's not very much, $10-$15. And they have a dinner once a year. There's no meetings, so to speak. They have a newsletter, which is kind of an afterthought. They have a dinner each year in which they have usually an astronaut speak. We've had something like 6 of the 10 moonwalkers. Paul, because of this, has gotten into the... there's apparently an association of astronauts, which he is kind of an associate member of an association, and goes to their dinners or invited to, and then picks up a speaker. And his wife got to know Jim Lovell, who's opened up a restaurant in Washington, in Chicago, and he was a speaker one time, and also went down to Antarctica looking for meteorites with us. And of course, as soon as we had Jim Lovell, why, it was picked up by Fox News, and we had a space on an internet, on several pages on their internet site.
Uh-huh. Now, how did I say?
Anyway, there was a lot of publicity, and I'm on the board of directors and have been for several years now, and so Paul was dealing with the Ventures Network in an attempt to find a ship. And he flew by Chicago. I can't think of his name right now. It starts with a D. Dowd, I think it is, who at the time owned it. He since sold it. But
sold what?
The Ventures Network. And now just operates the air arm of it or something. But he had the ships that he had leased from the Russian government, taking people to the North Pole and to Antarctica. Anyway, we went out and visited him in Darien, Connecticut, where they had their offices. Mm-hmm. And then he flew to Chicago.
You're talking about Quark.
Clark, yes, Quark. Right. Quark. That's exactly.
Venture Network is the flyers.
Right, which is, I think, what he now gives all his attention to.
Yeah,
He sold that off, and he keeps the... He sold one or the other off.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul, we all had lunch with him, and Paul said, well, you know, we'd like to possibly take quite a number of berths. If we thought we might be able to sell them to the people at the Mercantile Exchange. As it turns out, nobody was interested. That's just not their cup of tea. And they can't stand to be away from the market that much. But he said, we really need to know more about what it would be like. And he says, we'll send a rider down. And Paul said, Frank, you want to go? And I said, yeah. Do we leave this afternoon? And that's why I was aboard.
And this was when?
1994, near the end of the 94. It was probably in that we had the lunch. It was probably August of 94.
On the Dranitsa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but you didn't collect meteorites on that trip.
Hmm?
You didn't collect meteorites on that trip.
No. I was going down to see what the ship was like. Mm-hmm. I also had to investigate. One of the things we wanted to do was in Peru. I went down to the Peru 10 days earlier and looked for places where we felt that the people we would sell the seats to would bring their wives, but their wives wouldn't want to go to Antarctica. So we found, I looked at some of the, that's kind of their Riviera, right down by Valparaiso, or just north of Valparaiso. So I went through that area and got the names of some nice hotels, all for nothing, because nothing came of it. Mm-hmm. But we also thought that we might get some official help from the Mercantile Exchange, but they were already into this go public mode, and they weren't spending money like they used to. They would give culturally $500,000 a year to the opera, and you know, they give away $4 or $5 million a year, and we felt maybe we could get them to sponsor something.
Well,
like
Lovell
this.
And company went down to Antarctica this last season.
No, it was two seasons.
Two seasons ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll tell you who.
And where did they go? Where did they go in Antarctica?
They flew. They had a very truncated trip. But they flew to Patriot Hills, and then they took a otter, and they flew out to wherever it is he's hunting up meteorites, and I don't know where that is, but it's some place that he's discovered or felt was a good place, and they found maybe 10 or 15 meteorites. And then they went to the South Pole, and of course they welcomed arms because of Lovell. In fact, so much so that the civilian in charge of building the new pole came to our dinner last March.
Jerry Marty?
Yeah.
Marty?
The tall, thin fella.
With the blonde hair?
I think so,
yeah. Okay, so Lovell and Company collected meteorites. Now, was this authorized by the National Science Foundation?
Well, yeah, they know about it. You know, we have to file with them, I guess, whatever we file.
Well, the Antarctic Treaty says you can't take anything out unless it's a scientific specimen.
Well, that's what it is, scientific specimen.
Well, I mean, under guidance.
Paul does, he's one of the, you know, there's a big,
so
there's
they,
a doomsday.
They all go back to Harper College for analysis.
Okay. Yeah. We also buy meteorites from Sahara. We've got someone, a couple of Frenchmen that we've hired, that are looking for meteorites in the Sahara, that they sell us a piece of it.
Are they working with the guys from NASA to look at the meteorites?
No, they don't. We do our own work.
University of Pittsburgh?
I think University of Pittsburgh is involved.
Yes.
But we file it. There's a doomsday book somewhere. Mm-hmm. Where every meteorite that's found is analyzed in a certain way, given a number and a name, Pusey location, and then whatever sort of meteorite it is. And Paul does that sort of work. And he's behind because we've got so many meteorites that we've picked up. But he's slowly categorizing all of them and filing them.
Mm-hmm. So they're part of the worldwide database for meteorites. The Japanese have most of them.
Yeah, they got 5,800. They just found someplace
this last year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Putting that in the polar time. Okay, you've been to Antarctica. You're now taking over as secretary of the Polar Society. You've obviously kept in touch with the Antarctic since you left. How's it affected your life? Your time down there. Looking back on it,
I think it changed my whole. View. I no longer was interested in the Navy career. I might have stayed in the Navy had I not gone to Antarctica. I've got a much keener interest in scientific matters. It got me into the Planetary Studies Foundation, into the Explorers Club, into people like yourself. Because of my time down there, I'm involved in a lifelong hobby, if you want to call it that, avocation. Interest more than a hobby or an avocation. It's a lifelong interest that has dominated my life. And I would have loved to have gone back on another expedition. I would love to go back with Paul, and someday I will. Unfortunately, they're very expensive expeditions to go on. We want $50,000 contribution from each person, unless they happen to take a Apollo 13 out there and back, and you've got a name. And obviously, I don't have $50,000 I want to spend on a 2-week trip or a 3-week trip. But, it's changed my whole life. There's no question about it. Antarctica was I read so much down there about history and philosophy and whatnot.
Did you meet Admiral Byrd by any chance?
No, I never have met Admiral Byrd.
He died in
He died when I was down there. I met Buddy Waite, Uncle Buddy Waite. I met Wright, who was down there with Scott. I've met a whole slew of them in there. Great stories. Schumberg. I came out one day, and there was this guy who was living in my hut, who was pecking away at the ice that was on our steps, because it used to melt. You know, they built those things terribly, and the heat would escape from the huts, melt it, and it dripped down, and you'd have a slick of ice. And he was out there chopping away, and I chopped away a little bit, and I said, "Hi, I'm Frank Stokes." He says, "I'm Zum Neuberger." And later he died, and but before he did that, he was chancellor of the University of Southern California and a number of famous things. And I bought some Antarctic books from one of those Antarctic book dealers, novels about Antarctica, and darn if I didn't open them up, and they're written in the, and the flap was from the library of Zum Neuberger. And
his wife sold the library out?
Somebody did.
I know her.
Somebody did, because I got the book at home.
She's living in, I think we're done.
Yeah. This is just chit-chat at this
point. I wanted a retrospect, so that was good, and I think we can end it there. So we'll do that.